You will now be placed into the conference.
Welcome to today's Indiana Chamber of Commerce Policy Issue Conference Call, hosted by Mr. Tom Schuman. During the presentation, all lines will be in a listen-only mode. If you have a question at any point during today's presentation, please press 01. Again, to ask a question, press 01 at any time. Thank you for your attention. At this time, I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Tom Schuman.
Thank you, and welcome to our monthly policy issue conference call. I am Tom Schuman, Senior Vice President of Communications with the Indiana Chamber. As you all know, this is a policy issue conference call. We realize policies alone are not going to solve the opioid crisis that's impacting our state and nation, but we feel this is certainly an important discussion to have, not only here, but throughout many forums. There's no shortage of statistics about this epidemic. I'll throw out just a few, and I'm sure we'll get into some more Indiana-specific numbers, but just read recently, 100 Americans die of opioid overdoses daily, more than the number killed in car crashes or by guns. In 2016, more people died from drug overdoses than the total number of Americans who were killed in the Vietnam War. In Indiana, opioid overdose deaths increased 52% from 2015 to 2016. And state police drug-related arrests increased 40% during that same time period. On the same day he was sworn into office as Indiana's 51st governor, Eric Holcomb signed an executive order creating the position of executive director for drug prevention, treatment, and enforcement. Jim McClellan, who enjoyed a 41-year career with Goodwill Industries of Central Indiana, accepted that daunting challenge. Jim, thank you for joining us today, for the great work that you're doing, and speaking to our chamber members on this important topic.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Well, as we begin our discussion, a reminder, again, you can weigh in anytime throughout the call. Simply dial 0 followed by 1 to ask a question or comment. Jim, let's go back to that day one of Governor Holcomb's term about 10 months ago. From your perspective, was it even possible at that time to kind of conceive the depth of the challenge that we face here with this drug epidemic?
It might have been possible, but I didn't conceive of how complex this problem is and how many pieces there are to it. It's enormous. And early on, we decided we were going to have to take a strategic approach to it, develop some sort of a strategic framework to guide us in our decision-making, or we could just very easily end up playing whack-a-mole, and that's not going to solve the problem.
Yeah, the governor wrote an opinion piece last week about how he did not intend for this to be part of his agenda. But all that changed as he traveled the state during the 2016 campaign. Did you have any prior experiences during your time at Goodwill, or what have been some of the stories that, since you've been in this role, that have impacted you that have really brought this to the forefront?
Well, I didn't have a lot of exposure to it before I took on this challenge, but I can tell you that early on and continuing, I have met so many people who have been affected by this directly or had a very close friend or relative affected by it. I've gotten to know a number of people who have struggled with an opioid use disorder, who have been through treatment, who are in recovery. I've known some others who are still struggling with it. And they come from all walks of life, and they're in our cities, our suburbs, our small towns, and our rural areas. And the more I've gotten into this, the more I've realized how pervasive it is, and how much it's affecting all parts, not only of this state but of the country, and certainly it's affecting employers.
Yeah, and we'll get into that much more. And that's really one of the purposes of the call today is bring it to the employer or employee level and what can be done. You talked about the strategic approach and data-driven approaches being so critical. We saw that in the long-term transportation funding. We've seen it with workforce initiatives. Talk about some of the efforts that have taken place to gather that data and how that's led to some of the informed decisions that have been made in recent months.
There's a lot of data out there, but a lot of it has been siloed. And one of the challenges that we took on pretty early was to start bringing some of those data sets together across the various state agencies into the Management Performance Hub in the State House, which is turning out to be a really terrific resource. We managed to get an MOU signed by, I think it's now 16 or 17 different state agencies to share data. And so we're bringing a lot of that into the Management Performance Hub now, and being able to sift through that and glean some insights that otherwise we'd be lacking. At the same time, we've also partnered with the Pew Charitable Trusts at no cost to the state. We're one of only two states that they're doing this with right now, and they chose us. And they're doing quite a lot of data analysis and then policy assessment also for us. And we'll get some preliminary preliminary report on what they're coming up with sometime in the next few weeks. But a lot of emphasis on the data side. But also, there's so much more to it. Once you've got the data, you've got to take some action, and so we've been pretty busy on a number of fronts there too.
Jim, one of the steps earlier this year was the addition of some treatment centers. Can you talk about how the data helped inform that, where those treatment centers are?
Yeah, actually, the data was very helpful in looking at overdose rates, opioid death rates in various parts of the state. Putting that, overlaying that with access to treatment. How far does an individual have to go? What are some of the wait times? And we selected five different locations around the state for new opioid treatment programs. And those will all be opened up between now and July 1 next year.
Jim, let's break it down by the three areas that are included in kind of in your position and in the effort that's going on here. We're talking prevention, treatment, and enforcement. When we look at prevention, what are some of the takeaways? How much of this is preventable, and what are some of the key steps in that area?
A lot of this current problem has been driven by overuse and misuse of opioid prescription pain medications. And our opioid prescription rate in the state in 2013 we were the ninth highest. We've managed to bring our opioid prescription rate down. Over the last 3 years, we're now 11th highest. It's come down, actually, 21.4%. We're still higher than the national average substantially, but we're moving in the right direction. What has happened is with the overprescription of opioid pain medications, and this has really been going on for a good while now. This isn't something that's happened overnight. A lot of that, people are getting it, of course, from their doctors, legally prescribed pain medications. And they assume it's safe, and they take it. And unfortunately, a number of people become dependent on these pain meds, and eventually that can turn into an addiction. At some point, you have to have more because your body develops a tolerance for it. And then A lot of that, if there are extra pills, for example, if someone has a procedure or is prescribed for an opioid for some acute situation and has 25 or 30 pills left over, and they sit in a medicine cabinet, a lot of that has been diverted and used for non-medical use. And so there are several things that we've done. And then at some point, a lot of individuals unfortunately turn to heroin, which is plentiful and it's very inexpensive. Now the heroin is laced with fentanyl, which is incredibly potent, and people don't really know what they're buying on the streets. And they inject it, and unfortunately that's what's causing a lot of these spikes in overdoses and deaths. But there are a couple things that we've done. Well, first of all, there was some legislation passed. The Senate enrolled Act 226 in the last session of the General Assembly, limiting prescriptions to first-time patients and to children and youth to no more than 7 days. Now, there are provisions in that legislation for exceptions to be made. And I think that's important. I think there are situations, there are individual situations where exceptions need to be made. But that's one step that we've taken. We're working very closely with the Indiana Hospital Association and also with the State Medical Association on prescriber guidelines for opioids, on prescriber education on opioids and on substance use disorder in general. There's a lot of work going on and a lot of cooperation from both of those associations, and these are efforts that that will be ongoing. It's just incredibly important that those who are prescribing, and it's not just surgeons or primary care docs. It's also dentists. There's been too much over-prescribing by some in the dental profession, and let me just say too that this is not anything that's that everybody is doing, and it's not anything that nobody intentionally intends to create an addiction in anyone. It's right. Something that's happened over time, and really, you can go back to 1990s, and an emphasis on treating pain more aggressively as being somewhat at the root cause of a lot of this.
Jim, a couple follow-ups there. When you talked about the limits on prescription lengths, Senator Donnelly was in with our executive committee earlier this year and kind of talked about that a little bit on a national level. Do you see any momentum gaining to make that broader, to kind of tighten those limits on prescription lengths?
I don't know how this is likely to play out at the national level. I know there's a lot of attention being given to it in a number of states, and I know there are states, including our neighbor to the south, that have tighter restrictions on first-time opioid prescriptions. I think Kentucky is now 3 days. What we have here is a big improvement over what we had before, which really wasn't very much. And so I think we're taking this we're taking it a step at a time, really. And I think through additional education of patients and prescribers, we can make a lot of headway on this. The Christie Commission, I will say, I think I like their recommendations. How much of that is actually going to get implemented remains to be seen. But I think from a national perspective, they've certainly got a good handle on the problem and on some of the possible solutions.
I believe I saw just earlier this week that New Jersey Governor Christie is going to be coming to Indianapolis for an event on this topic.
That's the Attorney General's prescription opioid and heroin event that's been held, was started by the previous Attorney General and is being continued by Attorney General Hill.
Yeah. You talked about the challenge of prescriptions that are diverted to other uses. This obviously appears to be a situation where the statistical data is not there, but more anecdotally, is there any sense of how large a problem that is? And again, we're talking about someone who didn't receive the prescription, who may be taking the pills from a family member, a friend, someone else, and using them.
70 to 80% of people who are addicted to heroin got their start on prescription pain meds. Of those, 70% got the pills from a friend or a relative, either by buying them or stealing them. So it's a big part of the problem.
And the connection to heroin that you mentioned, is that primarily driven by someone, they start with the pills and establish some type of addiction, and when they don't have access to the pills anymore, they move on to heroin or something else?
Yes, exactly. And the heroin is very inexpensive. And there's a lot of it out there.
Well, Jim, the situation that you described of the current methods of prescriptions, how long they are, the pain management, I think it, just kind of backing up what you said, that appears, from my perspective, to be just something that developed as the natural course of healthcare of trying to treat patients. And I guess, is that a fair assessment? And then now the education is a way of, okay, we did that previously, it worked, but now there's problems associated. We need to educate. We need to make adjustments.
We have 5% of the world's population in this country, and we use between 80 and 85% of all the opioid pain medications. I think we have a culture where, I'm not advocating that anybody should experience severe pain, but the idea that we should be able to go through life without experiencing any pain, regardless of what happens to us or what we do to ourselves, is not realistic. And there are alternatives out there. Now, they don't work for everybody, and there are valid uses for opioid pain medications, particularly for acute situations. They were not intended to be used for chronic pain. I recognize that there are a lot of people who are taking them for chronic pain, and I think that individuals who are in that situation, you can't just cut them off. They're going to go through withdrawal, and there has to be some individual attention paid to what are the alternatives and what recourse do they have. But alternative means alternative therapies, alternative treatments are available. There are combinations of some of the over-the-counter pain relievers that work very well for some people. This is something that's it's individual. It's something that more medical professionals are taking a very serious look at and using, and it's something that we're certainly encouraging. One of the problems with this epidemic, though, is that one size doesn't fit all, and this is true with respect to any of the three drugs that are approved by the FDA for treatment of an opioid use disorder: methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone, in one form, the brand name is Vivitrol. And there isn't one of them that works for everybody. So these are individual situations just require an individual approach, and that's something that we're trying to help educate people about. There's information about these various medications, some of the pluses and minuses on our the next level recovery website that went live a week ago. And it's something that that we would encourage anyone who is experiencing a problem with an opioid use disorder, or has someone close to them who is, to explore this and find out what resources are available to them.
Yeah, I want to give that website address, and we will include it in a follow-up that we send to all of the participants today, but that is in.gov/recovery. Talk about the importance of that website. As you said, part of the education process, I had a chance to look through it earlier this week. Talk about some of those resources and how it can help people suffering from problems, help providers. It seems to be a valuable resource.
Well, we hope it's really going to become a go-to resource for anyone who wants information about substance abuse, anyone who wants information about resources that are available to treat a substance use disorder. What we found was that there wasn't any one place for people to go, and people would say, where can I find help? How do I get information on this? What resources are out there? And we couldn't find any one site. You had to jump from one to another to another. And so we started working on the development of one platform that people could go to and find the type of information they were looking for. We also have on that website links to other sites that are trustworthy. And we'll continue to add to that website. We'll continue to revise it, to improve it, make it as user-friendly and helpful as possible. And it's something that we expect to just continue evolving rather continuously.
Jim, one additional follow-up. I apologize for not knowing this in advance, but the legislation you mentioned that limits prescriptions to 7 days under certain conditions, did that go into effect then earlier this year?
It went into effect July 1.
I knew that was typically the case. Just wanted to confirm that.
Right.
A reminder to our members on the phone today, again, you can call in with your questions, comments, 01 on your phone, and you'll be placed in queue to weigh in with Jim McClellan. Let's focus a little bit on the treatment aspect of this situation. We talked about some treatment centers being added this year, but what are the keys to reaching people to try to get that message out to someone that they may have a problem and that treatment should or could be pursued?
Well, access to treatment is just crucial for somebody that is ready for help. And unfortunately, it's not always available when and where it's needed. If a person who's been struggling with this, ready, express that desire for help, that's exactly when they need it. And if they contact a treatment facility and are told, sorry, we don't have room, come back in a week or two, that might be too late. And so part of what we want to do and we're working to make possible is much more timely access to treatment. Now, there's a terrific program going on at Eskenazi Hospital in Indianapolis called Project Point, where there is a counselor in the emergency department, and someone who is revived from an overdose is connected with that counselor before they don't leave the emergency department until they've been connected with that counselor, and then that individual works with them to try to talk to them about treatment. And if they're amenable to it, to connect them immediately. And this is more often possible in a larger metropolitan area like Indianapolis than it is in some smaller areas and more rural areas. But part of what we're going to be doing is putting more of those peer recovery coaches in emergency departments in some particularly high-need areas around the state. And we'll be doing that with part of the money that the state received this spring as a result of a grant made possible by the 21st Century Cures Act that Congress passed last year. So there's another area where timely access to treatment, when and where it's needed, is now possible in some areas. The LaPorte and Griffith police departments, and in LaPorte, the fire department's also involved, have adopted something called a police-assisted addiction and recovery initiative. It's really it's modeled after what's come to be known as the ANGEL program in Gloucester, Massachusetts, where an individual can walk into the police station and say, I've got a heroin addiction and I want help, and they're not going to get arrested. They're going to be connected with treatment. And they've taken this approach in LaPorte and in Griffith. I heard a presentation from a representative of the Griffith Police Department recently where he talked about this program being launched 4 months earlier. And in that four-month period, they had 9 people come in and ask to be connected to help. And in 8 of those cases, they were able to connect them with a treatment provider within 2 hours. Now, they're using volunteers, and in one case, they're using some AmeriCorps workers to help with this. But in the 9th case in Griffith, they couldn't find a place that had room. And so a volunteer spent 10 hours of his own time calling around every place he could think of, finally found the treatment provider on the south side of Chicago that said, bring him over, and he drove him over there and got him in. Now, this is the kind of approach that we would like to see replicated much more widely around the state. But unfortunately, if the treatment isn't available in that area, it's not realistic. This is another reason why we're just putting so much emphasis on expanding treatment capacity. You know, if we somehow could magically prevent anyone else from becoming addicted to opioids, we still have in this state tens of thousands of people who do have an opioid use disorder and who need the treatment. And so that has to be a very, very high, and is a very high priority for us. Of course, an even higher priority than that is just making sure that we do everything we can to help keep people alive, and that has a lot to do with the availability and use of naloxone, or Narcan, which is the brand name for it, which is the reversal agent for an opioid overdose.
And Jim, what you described, what's taking place in LaPorte and Griffith, that's very powerful, and it would be easy to say, yeah, let's replicate that as many places as possible. But as you also pointed out, if the treatment options aren't there, then it eventually won't be as successful as it could be.
Correct.
We talked again, we mentioned the additional treatment centers that were added. Part of the challenge there, obviously, is money. If we could shake the magic money tree and have the resources available, but what are some of the next steps that are taking place in order to try to expand the treatment options?
There are some pilot programs that were authorized by legislation in the last session. Senate Enrolled Act 510, for example, will create enable the creation of a program in Allen County in which the courts are involved, and it provides it'll provide a range of residential treatment and recovery options, we're really looking forward to seeing that launched. They're still locking in a site for it. We'll support that program whenever they're ready, but there also was some other legislation that would enable the creation of some pilot programs, again, where the justice system is involved in Wayne, Marion, and Tippecanoe counties, And those have, right now the ball is in the courts of those three counties, and we're prepared to support those as well whenever the local counties are ready for it. But we're looking forward to seeing how successful these are, and of course from that experience can decide if we want to replicate or scale them.
Jim, how big of a challenge is the stigma for individuals of admitting that they might have a problem, that they need help? How difficult is it? Can you
it's huge, Tom.
Yeah,
the stigma is enormous. It's an enormous problem. And that's part of what we're trying to address. FSSA recently announced the launch of a stigma reduction or humanizing campaign, and there's a linked part of that on the Next Level Recovery website. But people, there is just so much misinformation about this disease. Unfortunately, I think a lot of it harkens back to some of the addictions of past generations. And this one is really different. It is affecting people from all walks of life. It cuts across all the socioeconomic lines. You know, there are at least two mayors of cities in this state who have grown children with substance use disorder. You know, the mayor of Nashville, Tennessee, their son died of an overdose within the last several weeks. And so part of what we're trying to do is get stories of recovery out there showing that, yes, this does affect people from all walks of life, and that treatment is available, and that recovery is possible. But also people need to understand that with an opioid addiction or an opioid use disorder, there have been changes in the structure of the brain, and it's almost impossible for people to just say to quit and recover through sheer willpower. It's not something that let's just say it might be theoretically possible, and there might be a few people who can do it, but it's rare. I guess the message here is there are a variety of paths to addiction. Once a person is addicted to an opioid, though, you really have a chronic disease, and the brain structure has changed and will continue to change the longer you use it. But treatment is available. Few can recover without treatment, but with treatment, recovery is definitely possible, and it's quite possible, and we know a number of situations where people have been able to go through treatment to recover, to become or return to being productive, contributing members of their communities. And here I think it's also important to understand that compared with other treatment of other addictive substances such as cocaine and meth, treatment for an opioid addiction typically takes longer and the risk of relapse is higher. So it's really important that people in recovery, especially the early stages of recovery, have a strong support system around them. They really need wraparound supports, similar to, for example, what we've known for a long time about some of the kinds of supports that are necessary for an individual coming out of prison. Very early on, they need a decent place to live and they need a job. And the same thing is true with people in recovery. And if they don't have family that's able to, or a network of really close friends who are able to provide those supports, then this is something that communities need to do. I was in a community over in the eastern part of the state earlier this year, and I was talking with a member of a volunteer recovery support group who told me that what they were trying to do was create a safe, supportive, loving community for people who were struggling with addiction. I thought, well, that's that's a pretty neat goal for us, for a community to have. And it's not a judgmental thing. It's more along the lines of compassion. You know, this epidemic, while it does cut across all socioeconomic lines, it does tend to thrive in areas that are more economically challenged, and where there might be, more despair. In fact, this isn't really considered one of the diseases of despair. And so as much as possible, what we want to try to do is replace despair with hope, that there is hope for recovery and a better life.
Jim, we didn't talk about this early on, but there's really not a dividing line in this epidemic between urban and rural. Is there the impacts being felt throughout the state and nation?
The risk factors are higher in areas, areas such as southeastern Indiana, eastern Kentucky, southwestern Ohio, all of West Virginia, basically Appalachian areas. It does tend to thrive in areas that have been hit hard by a loss of the factories that provided a substantial part of the economic base. This is true also up in New England. We see some of the highest rates of opioid abuse and deaths in some of the New England states as well. So there is some variation there, but it's in all types of communities.
This is the operator. We do have a few questions from the audience if you would like to get those at this time.
Absolutely.
Sure. The first comes from Katie. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for taking my question. I work for NARF. We are a trade association, and our members provide services to people with disabilities. And one thing that is kind of on the fringes of this discussion is children that are born with addiction. That is impacting, obviously, the disability industry significantly in that kids that are born with addiction and with a neonatal abstinence disorder or neonatal abstinence syndrome diagnosis are automatically eligible for services, Medicaid services, through FSSA, and currently there's no funding for that, and there are not enough therapists to provide those services. So are you looking at early intervention as you approach this issue?
Yes, we are, and thank you for bringing that up, Katie, because I will tell you there is nothing about this epidemic that troubles me more than the impact on children. And certainly babies born with a neonatal abstinence syndrome I can't imagine how it's possible for there to be any more innocent a victim than a newborn who has to go through withdrawal. And every 25 minutes somewhere in this country, a baby is born with neonatal abstinence syndrome. And it's a heartbreaking thing. So, yes, we are taking Senate Enrolled Act 446, is going to expand the Fresh Start Recovery Program that Volunteers of America is operating in Indianapolis. And it's going to enable them to expand that program. It's going to enable them to set up a second program in Winchester, Indiana, residential, where new moms and their babies, the moms are going through treatment, and the moms and the babies will be able to stay together. And then there will there's provision in that legislation for a third site somewhere in southern Indiana that hasn't been selected yet, but we're supporting that. DCS is just incredibly affected by this situation. The number of children removed from their homes in last year because of parental substance abuse was 22% higher than in 2015, and those kinds of situations now account for over 52% of all removals by DCS. So there are grandparents raising children, and I know of a couple of sets of great-grandparents raising children because of both the parents and the grandparents have problems with addiction. It's something that and then there are children who are losing their parents. I was at an event a few weeks ago where an 11-year-old boy was talking about how his father had died of a heroin overdose just 2 weeks earlier. And here's the thing I think we all need to keep in mind, that if as a society we don't do enough to help mitigate the impact on all these children, I think that we're going to pay a heavy price for it 10, 15, 20 years down the road. Now, about the funding issue, it's very real. We're very concerned about it. Exactly what steps we're going to be able to take to help mitigate this, I really don't know right now, but it's very much on our agenda. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. Next question.
Yes, next question comes from Kevin. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Jim. Kevin Bringer with the Chamber. I'm actually calling from a remote location. You touched on it earlier, Tom's question about stigmatism, but could you talk a little bit about that with respect to the workplace and returning employees and what employers can and should do to help destigmatize employees who have developed addictions and are trying to integrate back into the workplace vis-a-vis the other employees in that workplace?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Kevin. Of course, I mean, we've got two major problems here right now, among lots of others, but pertaining to this issue, we've got people who have achieved some level of recovery who need to get back to work. And then we have a lot of employers, as all of you, I'm sure, are well aware, who are having difficulty filling all their vacancies because not enough of their applicants can pass a drug test. So I think a lot of what employers can do is educate your employees, your coworkers, your customers, educate your own kids through EAPs, support employees who have or whose dependents have a substance use disorder, help them with recovery supports. Be sure that or take a look at drug screening policies. I mean, we certainly don't advocate anything that's going to help create dangerous situations. But if an individual, for example, is on a maintenance dose of of one of the three medications that I happen to mention, two of those actually have an opioid base, methadone and buprenorphine, and yet they enable a lot of people in recovery to maintain pretty normal lives. But they're going to show up on a tox screen. So be sure that you're aware of the presence of those particular drugs and look at the individual situations. And I would say, too, that to the extent that you might be able to help provide some employment opportunities for people who are in recovery, this is something that we'd like to see a lot more employers take part in. You know, DWD and Department of Workforce Development, and in conjunction with Department of Correction, has a program that's known as HIRE that is providing opportunities for people who are exiting some of our state facilities. And they've had some really good success with greatly reduced recidivism and success in the employment in employment of a lot of these individuals. And a substantial number of those were incarcerated because of some substance use violation. And so being in a position to give a chance to people who might even have a low-level felony conviction, as well as a history of some substance use problem, would be a huge help in many situations, and we'd like to see a lot more of that. But I think educating people, being part of local coalitions that are addressing substance abuse prevention and treatment and recovery are ways that employers can really really contribute towards solutions. I think you could also, in some cases, and I know Lawrence County is a good example of this, help expand the availability of sober living opportunities for people in recovery, and just support employees who have or whose dependents are struggling with this, and do what you're able to do to help provide them with supports in recovery.
Yeah, a quick follow-up on that, Jim. I again read something nationally where some companies, organizations are taking the step of management employees are willing to come forward and share their stories, whether it affected them personally or people they know, sharing those with employees to help, again, reduce that stigma and humanize it even more, I guess, to make allow people to feel more comfortable coming forward.
And I think that's hugely helpful in many situations. I really applaud those who are willing to do that and to show you know these are your neighbors in many cases. So I really encourage that type of sharing of some of these personal stories.
Do we have any additional questions?
We have one additional question from Gloria. Please go ahead.
Hi, Jim. Thank you so much for your leadership. Earlier you noted that 70 to 80%, this is Gloria Sachta from the Employers Forum of Indiana, my apologies. So earlier you noted that 70 to 80% of people on heroin started by using prescription opioids that they had obtained from medication sitting around from family and friends. Could you comment on ideas to remove excess opioids out of homes, off the streets, including
yes.
an idea of having pharmacies participate in taking back drugs? Currently, pharmacies are not permitted beyond the once-a-year DEA take-back day to take back prescription drugs, but this just seems if we could perhaps from a policy perspective, address this. Pharmacies
yes.
are on every corner, and it might be an easy win for our communities.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks so much for that question. We really need for there to be a lot more take-back opportunities, and we'd like to see them available all the time. And this is something that we've been talking with the Indiana Hospital Association about. And you might also be aware that CVS just announced that they're going to establish more take-back kiosks. And I think they're going to add another 750 around the country. They're not starting in Indiana. We certainly are going to take a look at that situation and do everything that we can to encourage more of those kinds of opportunities. There is a link on our Next Level Recovery website to take back opportunities in the state and places that are available for people to take their excess medications. But we want to see that expanded a lot. It's terribly important. You know, I hear stories of people who go around to real estate open houses on Sunday afternoons, and you know, looking through the house, and they open up the medicine cabinets, and they'll take if there's anything in there, they'll take it, and it's people whose
parents or grandparents might have a number of these pills in bottles in their medicine cabinets, and children or grandchildren get hold of them. And this is one way this thing spreads, and we want to reduce the opportunities that they have by providing more accessible and available take-back opportunities. There's some other ideas out there that again we're looking at, and that might provide even more convenient ways. But we're not ready to talk about them yet.
Thanks for the question. We've got about 5 minutes remaining. Jim, one other area of potential employer role, as far as training and education of managers, supervisors to potentially help spot addiction or be aware of some of the signs, do you see that as an area that could be a strong emphasis?
Yes, and I think that's really important. Not only from a safety standpoint, but also from the standpoint of trying to help employees get the help that they need. The National Safety Council has some information. We have a link on the website to some information that might be helpful along those lines. You could also sponsor lunch and learn sessions, bring speakers in. I spoke recently to Safety Coalition leadership of a large employer in the state, and there are other people who can do that probably better than I can. But being aware of the possible signs, you can find a little bit of that on our website right now, and hopefully we'll have even more down the road. But there's some good resources out there. And I think that that's something that could be useful in many situations.
Jim, we've seen some instances around the country of some lawsuits being filed, and then here in Indianapolis, a press conference yesterday with Mayor Hogsett talking about the city of Indianapolis suing opioid makers and distributors. Any thoughts on that that situation?
Well, I'll have to let that process unfold. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not going to get into any of the potential there. But I think everyone is aware of the tobacco settlement that brought a lot of money into states to deal with another type of addiction over the last number of years. But we'll have to see how this process unfolds. Of course, Purdue Pharma they did pay over $600 million in fines for misleading marketing. The company and some of its executives for some misleading marketing that was done in the early 2000s that really had a hand in the current problem. I can't really comment though any further on the likelihood that any of these will succeed.
Didn't want to put you on the spot there, but didn't want to let that pass without the opportunity to throw it out. As we wrap up, again, I want to throw out a couple of other numbers. And again, the Chamber and everyone will never minimize the impact this is having on families and communities. But again, when it comes to employers, some national numbers study, up to 25% of job applicants are failing drug tests. Study in the Wall Street Journal from Princeton University talking about lower labor force participation rates over the last 15 years, and they're lower in areas that have had these higher instances of drug problems. It seems logical, but when we think about that participation rate is at such a low level. in the final minutes, Jim, your closing comments, your thoughts, the work that's taken place so far, and kind of where Indiana's headed next.
Well, we've got a lot that we're working on right now, and you'll see some more announcements coming out over the next several weeks about some of the things that that are going on. I would say though that you know, to really solve this, we need to not only help individuals who have this problem, but we need to do everything we can to strengthen the fabric of our communities. And it's some of the kinds of things the Chamber's been working on for years. You know, it has to do with education, economic development, creating the kinds of communities that people really want to live in. We haven't talked much about prevention other than from the standpoint of limitations on prescriptions and access to excess opioids, but they're trying to make sure that young people are developing the kinds of coping skills that are going to help them deal with some of the temptations and enable them to resist using any kind of addictive substance, because we know that the younger a person starts using, a child, for example, or an adolescent starts using any kind of addictive substance, the greater the likelihood of a problem in adulthood. And there are some good programs out there. There are some good initiatives going on in a number of communities around the state, and we would encourage employers to be part of those and bring the pieces together from all parts of a community to address this problem.
Jim McClellan, thank you for speaking with our members today and for all of your efforts in this regard. Very much appreciated.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
And that final message, to just reinforce what Jim said, for employers, it's find a way that you can hopefully be part of the solution. It is a much bigger problem than a challenge, and it's taking place in our workplace. It's affecting our communities. It's affecting our state. So it's strength in numbers of everyone working together to be part of the solution. I mentioned earlier the website, in.gov/recovery. Again, we'll include that and some other important links in our follow-up email that you'll receive later today. We will return on November 3rd, Friday, November 3rd, with our next policy call, subject to be determined as we schedule our last couple policy calls for this year. Several other important chamber events coming up, our annual dinner, 28th annual awards dinner on November 7th, and our 2018 legislative preview taking place on November 20th. So again, thank you for joining us today and for your support of the Indiana Chamber. Have a wonderful Friday and weekend.
Thank you all for your attention. This concludes today's conference call. All participants may now disconnect.